you know, I guess I don't really know, but it seems unlikely that that would work out.
Yeah. But, yeah. So.
So.
Did you see this keychain Ellen got me?
I did see that keychain that Ellen got you.
The worst town in the world.
Ogilvy. Why is St. Paul the worst town in the world?
St. Paul is not the worst town in the world. St. Paul is...
Okay, obviously you don't actually mean that it's the worst town in the world when you say that. And it wasn't asking, like, is this actually worse than Fallujah, all right?
The reason
I wanted to know why you don't like St. Paul.
The reason it's so bad is that it's so close to a town that's far better with no incentive for being in St. Paul.
Wait.
I never have an incentive to go to St. Paul when I'm in Minneapolis.
Oh, okay. So it's just bad by proximity.
Yeah, it's mildly cheaper. It's like, you know, you'd go to Oakland from San Francisco because it's cheaper to live there.
There are reasons to live in Oakland as well.
Okay, yeah. There's no reasons to live in St. Paul.
There might not be reasons to live in Oakland, but there are some areas in Oakland that are all right.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't think of them or why you would want to be in them.
But even the bad parts, at least it's cheaper. Like, St. Paul's, like, some neighborhoods are relatively cheaper than some neighborhoods in Minneapolis. But as a whole, it's not that much cheaper. It's just a much more boring version of Minneapolis, located right next to Minneapolis.
Can I share that I just have no context of what is and is not St. Paul and is and is not Minneapolis? Like, I know that there are things, like, I know of places I've been, and I know, like, yeah, that's in Minneapolis, or, like, I know, that's in St. Paul. Like, the Capitol Building. The Capitol Building is in St. Paul.
Why the heck would anyone go to the Capitol Building?
Well, I mean, so I haven't been there since school trips when I was young.
Okay.
But,
yeah.
I haven't, like, I know my aunt lives in St. Paul.
Mm-hmm.
And if I'm going to Minneapolis for something, I think, like, oh, I wonder if I have time to stop by her house. Because I just don't think of it being a different place.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, if I was traveling to... I guess if I was traveling to Oakland or San Francisco, it'd be pretty easy to switch between them. But there's a very clear distinction between the two. And I just have no distinction between the two.
Yeah.
So I'm curious as to why it wouldn't make sense to live in St. Paul.
Because, I mean, it's 14 miles away.
Is it 14 miles?
Yeah, they're like 14 miles apart. 14 miles apart?
I thought they were just touching.
No, they're not touching.
There's like
a
blurry line. There's just a blurry line.
Let me see it. Exactly. It's like 10 or 15 miles.
I don't think it's 15 miles.
Maps.
You maybe have to go 15 miles if you take one of the ring roads around it.
But I mean, because there's all the suburbs, it never feels like you're going anywhere, but... That's the whole problem with all the Twin Cities. You never really know where you are.
Yeah, because the Twin Cities is like 17,000 different cities.
Yeah.
And I mean, like, I don't really like Maple Grove. So why did Ellen give you that keychain that says St. Paul on it?
Ellen gave me this keychain that says St. Paul on it. And I quote, "I got you a cheaply crafted keychain with the name of your favorite city in Minnesota to serve as a reminder that A, I exist, and B, you will visit me." I'm questioning both of those. I'm not sure if she exists, and I don't think I'll visit her.
Okay, all right.
For the record, if you take 35W, which is a pretty major road, it's 14.2 miles from Minneapolis to St. Paul.
Did you just put it in Google Maps? Because then it's taking you from the center of one to the center of the other.
Well, obviously, that's what I'm saying.
I don't care about the center of one to the center of the other. I want to know, like, if you're on the far edge of one, that's and closest. So St. Paul is east of Minneapolis, right?
Yes.
Is that right? Okay, so if you're on the west edge of St. Paul and you want to travel to the east edge of Minneapolis, how far is that?
I don't know how to... you can't put, like... east edge of Minneapolis in the Google Maps.
MapQuest.
I always say it because, you know, they were kind of like, they definitely pioneered that whole thing, and then Google Maps perfected it.
It depends what you mean by pioneered, but
it depends.
Have you updated your phone yet? Are you using the new iOS 6? I think that's how it's pronounced, right? It's iOS.
I have not. I've not updated to the iOS 6.
I'd like to clarify here that anyone who pronounces it IOS is not my friend.
anyone who pronounces it iOS, if I hear you do it out loud, I will take your iPhone and smash it on the ground.
Yeah, it's so, nobody ever calls Windows by, like, you never say operating system or OS when you're really referring to Windows. You generally just say Windows and then the number or the letters. And there's a lot of different ways that people say Mac OS 10 point whatever. OS always sounds wrong. It is wrong by their brand standards.
Yeah.
So you haven't updated yet. Why not?
You know, I don't utilize my iPhone as much as I should.
Wait, and that might not be true. As much as you should?
Well,
just because you don't utilize it as much as other people doesn't mean you're not using it as much as you should.
I mean, I think it, as much as I love my iPhone and I don't want any other phone, it's definitely more phone than I need right now.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, it's probably more phone than anybody needs. But so I just haven't gotten around to it. Haven't really thought about it, to be honest. Like, the one thing I've been really curious about is the maps, because of all the, you know, uproar.
They look a hell of a lot better.
Yeah, I heard that.
And they load faster.
And I heard they're a lot easier to switch between each direction. You don't have to, like, hit that little button up in the top.
Yeah, are you on a 4S?
No, 4.
Okay, so I'm on a 4 as well, and the 4 doesn't get turn-by-turn directions.
Yeah.
Which means that, like, it won't read off, like, turn right in 3 blocks, and then, you know, when you turn left, it's like, you did it wrong. It's not actually like that. But what you do when you want to go through, instead of hitting a tiny little button that takes up a little corner, is you just swipe across the screen.
That makes a lot of sense.
It's a lot easier for just kind of moving one by one. It's maybe not easier to move through a bunch quickly, but you can also just look at a list, so I don't see why that's a problem.
Yeah. Did they get rid of the blue dot on the blue line?
It's an enhanced blue dot on a blue line. I never had a problem with that. There was never a lack of contrast for that.
No, it just seemed, I don't know. Like, why?
Why was it a blue dot on a blue line?
Yeah, like, why a blue?
Because when you start introducing more colors, it becomes garish.
Well, I don't even necessarily need a color. Like, why can't it just be a black dot?
A black dot? That would look horrible.
Black dot makes far more sense.
That would look horrible and probably be less usable, and I think that would actually blend into the background more. Also, a black dot? Come on.
Dude, I prefer black dots over blue dots in almost everything.
Yeah. that would be bad on a map.
I don't know. I always hate that thing where, like, you're like kind of lost and you're like driving in traffic and you pull it up, and this doesn't have to do with the blue dot, it has to do with, like, how long sometimes it takes to load. And you, like, flip it open, you're like, oh, I'm on the right page. I'm on track, I'm on the blue line. Then, like, it just loads and just goes, and your dot, like, moves, like, 8 blocks in the complete wrong direction. And you're like, oh, never mind. I got to turn around.
Did you have to do mapping projects when you were in school?
I have not yet.
Okay. Like, when you were in elementary school, I mean. Like, did they, like, fold out a map and, like, make you learn how to read directions?
Yeah.
And learn how
to... Yeah, yeah, yeah. You had to, like, we had to do one where we, like, planned a trip. And then we figured out, like, how many miles it was. We were each given a vehicle and then, like, figured out, like, how much gas we would use and stuff.
That's way more intense than what I had to do.
It was in, like, 7th grade. So.
Yeah. Yeah. What about like, mapping without having a strong map? Like, you're given a compass and a vague map. And you're told, like, get home or you don't get dinner.
Yeah, we did that in 4th grade.
All right.
Did you ever go to, like, we did it, like, on a field trip, and, like, we went to, like, this, like, national park, and we, like, did it in the park?
Yeah, yeah, I remember doing it. I think my dad was a chaperone for one of those ones.
That was one of the only things my dad chaperoned.
It was a good
one. Did, like, camping. So we, like, built the, like, camping fire and, like, ate around the fire and stuff.
Yeah, we didn't, I don't think we got that far.
We did that, but it was really strange, because it was, like, the middle of the day, and it was, like, ramen noodles. And so we were all hungry for the entire day. And I remember my dad being very irritable by the end because he'd only eaten ramen noodles.
Wait, you brought ramen noodles to a campfire?
Yeah. Well, that's like, we boiled it. Entirely
the incorrect food for fire.
Well, it was like, we were supposed, it was supposed to be like wintertime, and we would do like cross country skiing, and we like, one person hauled like the sled, and we had like all these checkpoints, and start a fire, and like make our food, and it didn't snow, and it didn't snow, and it didn't snow, so we didn't get to cross country ski, and then it was really hot, but they still forced us to wear snow pants.
What?
It was like, yeah, like I remember my dad being like, no, take your snow pants off, like you're going to overheat. And, like, I took them off before going into school, and my teacher was like, Tom, if you don't put your snow pants on, you can't come on the field trip.
Wow.
It's horrible.
Man, that's terrible.
Yeah.
I took a field trip with my orchestra, my high school orchestra, to New York City.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad was a chaperone on that. And previously, as a Christmas gift, my brother had given my dad a TV Begone, which is like a universal off remote. So it's just, it just bursts out like every standard off code for every television.
That's awesome.
Which is actually, it's really, really fun. It was a good prank, like walking around, you could like see people's TVs on through their window, so you turn them off.
Yep.
It also was really nice at like restaurants and things. If we'd go out to eat and there was a TV on, you know, you could turn it off, and generally no one's watching them at restaurants.
Mm-hmm.
Bars would be a different story, but you know,
yeah,
it's in high school, so my parents weren't really bringing me to bars all that often. so that was pretty cool. But there was one day when we were in some area of New York that was like high-priced clothing stores, and just something that I was not interested in at all, and really didn't want to be participating in that part. And so my dad and I snuck away from the group, and like they had given us a pretty clear boundaries of where we were supposed to go.
Yeah.
And we snuck into, I mean, we just left. We didn't sneak into New York, so we just walked away. And we went through this Sony building. And I remember thinking, it was like, I had been to a lot of Apple stores, and they were very pristine and had, like, displayed the electronics really beautifully. And I remember going in and being like, oh, this is going to be just like an Apple store, except it's going to be Sony stuff. And that's interesting, because I don't know much about Sony, and they make way more products. And like half of it was a museum, which was awesome because they just like showed old school recorders and stuff. And then half of it was a store, and it was disgusting. Like it was dirty, and the electronics looked cheap, and they were like half of them were those plastic shells that don't even have the electronics inside.
Oh, yeah.
And it was just, but then they had this huge wall of TVs.
And it
was like every TV they make. And they all went off at the same time, and it was awesome. It was so much fun. Cool. And then we ran away giggling.
I can just picture your dad. Oh, man. Yeah, I would picture a Sony store to look like a Sharper Image store, which usually look like a really oversized kiosk.
Yeah, I distinctly remember it being like disappointingly cheap seeming.
Yeah.
Like filled with these really expensive electronics. And it just made them all look bad.
Yeah.
This was pre-iPhone days, too.
Okay. So like, they were still pretty big.
Yeah, but they were, like, marketing their Walkmans against iPods. And that, of course
marketing their Walkmans.
Yeah.
I got in a argument with our friends.
Okay. You probably shouldn't say your last name here.
Oh, yeah, shoot.
We'll just bleep that out.
Especially when she's super, like, worried people are going to, like, steal her identity and doesn't even have a real name on Facebook and stuff.
Yeah, that is really strange.
Very strange. But she said...
You got in a conversation with our friend Mr. X.
Yeah, I got a conversation with my buddy Mr. X. And
she
said, I cannot wait to see if Microsoft is actually going to release a $200 tablet, because I really want that. And I said, no, you don't. And she claims that she does, mm-hmm. But my argument is that you would settle for that,
mm-hmm.
because it's cheap.
Yep.
Just like we settle for, you know, McDonald's, when we're in a hurry and we need a cheap meal. Nobody ever really wants that or like thinks about it ahead of time. Do they?
Yeah, some people want that. That's fine.
But yeah, she was like, I was thinking in my head, like, how that would look. a $200 Microsoft that, made
that tablet. Amazon one is like $250, right?
Is it? I don't know.
So and, probably. And, I mean, the original Kindle Fire was not released to astounding reviews, but the new one seems like, or you know, people that have written about it, seem to be saying that it has more potential and has improved in a lot of ways. And I want to say it's $250. We should verify that. But
yeah, I guess my mom has a Nook Color, which isn't much. That's around that same price range.
Yeah.
You have less. She can't. Maybe the new ones you can. I know on hers she can't like watch Netflix and stuff. But she has internet and she really enjoys. Like everything works really well. It's really easy to use.
So but, I really, really like to argue about whether or not tablets will replace paper books. And I guess I should say, I really like to argue with people that are delusional enough to think that tablets will not replace paper books. And one of the main complaints is always that they're really expensive, which means, you know, if you break them, you lose out on something. Whereas like a book, I mean, if you destroy a book, you're not losing as much, and they're much harder to destroy because they're somewhat more waterproof and such.
Yeah.
I could potentially see someone preferring a $200 tablet to a $500 tablet if price is less of an object because they feel like they can break the $200 tablet or be more careless with it.
That's true.
Right. And so, I mean, obviously the number of people that care about breaking, like care about the difference in price and are willing to break something that's $200 but not $500, but can afford both, and you know, it's prudent for them to afford both. That's probably a really small group of people, because generally, if you don't care about breaking a $200 electronic, you probably don't care that much about breaking a $500 electronic.
Yeah.
But it is a pretty significant difference.
Yeah.
Or I could see, like, if you have kids, you know, maybe you think the kid's breaking a $200 one, and you give them a $200 one for being a little kid.
Yeah, that's true. I'm just going to give my kids rocks.
Yeah. Well, I mean, blocks. You call those blocks, right?
No, I'm going to call them. No, like straight up just rocks.
Well, yeah, but you could spray paint them at least.
No. I'd probably make them dig them up out of the yard themselves.
Yeah, dig them up.
Did you hear I'm going to be an uncle?
You're going to be an uncle. You did tell me that, yeah.
My brother's going to have a baby. Super excited.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to be that weird uncle.
Wow. That's not surprising.
That weird. Everybody's got a weird Uncle Tom.
I see where this is going.
It's not going there.
All right.
Don't go there. Don't go there before. Don't take me there.
Don't force it there. All right.
No.
Yeah. Well, congratulations to you for becoming an uncle.
Yeah.
Not to your brother and sister-in-law for having a child, but
No. So all the congratulations go to me.
To you.
You can send cards. You can send cards and gifts to me as well.
Crazy Uncle Tom.
Yeah, well, I'm going to be out of the country when they have it.
Huh, convenient.
So I won't see it until it's like 2 months old. So I think like once a week I'm going to send it like bizarre things that I find in England.
It's not going to...
No, it won't. While it's happening, my brother and his wife... They'll probably end up just throwing it all away, which is too bad. But, like, in, like, 5 or 10 years, they'll be, like sitting there.
Tom was sending you lead pipe fixtures for sinks.
No, I'll send them, like, cool things, like ticket stubs for when I go to, like, the Louvre. And then they'll be learning about, like...
Do people still use ticket stubs?
I don't... Probably at the Louvre.
Why? That's you probably just pay them and then you sign.
Okay, well, I bet they have. I bet you anything. Tag. Bet you anything. You get the little pin, the little
metal through the bendy.
Yeah, tag. I'll send them that.
All right,
and they'll be like, you know, 10 years from now, maybe that'll seem cool, because I mean, obviously, this is more of an extreme, and I won't be able to, unless something radical happens while I'm over there, be this cool. But when my uncle was over in Germany. This was before I was born, but he was over there, and he was in Berlin when the Berlin Wall fell. Like, he, like, sledgehammered the wall down and, like, climbed over it and, like, partied in the streets of Berlin with the people.
Mm-hmm.
And so he brought back all of these, like, chunks of the Berlin Wall. And so then I was probably in, like, 6th or 7th grade, and we were learning about it. And I, like, was talking about it at dinner, like, hey, Mom and Dad, did you know that there was a Berlin Wall? And I was like, acting like I knew everything. And my mom was like, actually, we have pieces of that. And I got to bring him into school, and I was like the coolest kid for 10 minutes. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to...
Little did you know about the rocks you had been playing with since childhood were actually parts of the Berlin Wall.
No, I only played one game as a child. It's called The Floor is Lava.
The most dangerous game.
It means your parents can't afford toys this year.
Ooh, dark. Now, that is one of the best games. And I kind of wish there were adult-sized playgrounds so I could still play that game.
Yeah.
Because the ground is lava was always fun.
Yep, when you're in the playground. I also, did you ever play Shark?
Was it just the same game?
It was the same game, except somebody was it, and they were the shark.
Yep.
And then they could only touch the ground in, like, one or two colors on the playground.
Hmm.
And, like, the colors would change. Like, someone would, like, call out in, like, a rotation. So it'd be, like, blue monkey bars, so they could use the monkey bars and, like, these railings to get around and try to tag people.
And then if you were tagged, did you become another shark?
Yep.
Until there was one last man standing.
One person left, yeah. It's a really fun game.
Yep. They have that in Halo, too.
Mm.
It's only so fun.
It's only a little bit fun.
Yeah.
Also, went out for dinner last night for my birthday.
Mm-hmm. Happy birthday.
Thank you. I went to the White Horse.
Yep, as you do.
They had a special. They had a special on, it was a Euro pizza.
And
it was one of the best things I've eaten there.
Mm-hmm.
Very rich. I can only have like three pieces.
Really?
And they're pretty small slices. Very,
yeah,
so much
pieces
better
are not
cheese.
Very large there. Yeah.
No. Which was, I mean, it was really good, but too rich. I should. I mean, I ended up just like sharing it with everybody, but it's awesome.
Hmm. Good.
So,
good.
Thought I'd give you the update. No buffalo chicken sandwich.
The best sandwich.
Best sandwich. Do we want to jump into our content and the?
Well, I think before we get too far in, I would like to take a moment to tell our listeners a little bit about the network, because
what we're doing.
Some of the feedback I got was kind of related to Verb Mill as a podcast network and what that means. So I think it's
what
worth.
What does
noting.
It mean, Will?
What does it mean? Okay, so Tom and I are on this podcast that you are currently listening to. It's called The White Horse Courier. And the White Horse Courier is on a network called Verb Mill. The Verb Mill network can be found at verbmill.net and currently hosts only one other podcast, which is called Dwell On. This is a show that Owen Imholt and Adam Heinzen host. It's about homes and about how to design a home and what goes into a home and kind of living inside of a home. And so you can find both of those on iTunes by searching for their name, or you can get them from our website, verbmill.net. Just clearing up a little bit of confusion about what,
yeah.
You know, when I say the website, some people are a little confused. And with that, I think we could jump right into some of the follow-up we have from last week. Last week, of course,
yeah.
We looked at the first of the Levi's Go Forth campaign commercials,
mm-hmm.
And we posed the following question to our audience. We had a few, but it basically boils down to, what do you think about advertisers using existing art in their ads? So this is existing poems or existing music or other visual art or, you know, art inside of ads. And we were specifically interested in instances where the artist does not give permission. So like,
yep.
The Black Keys are featured in some car ads, and they obviously gave permission for that and you know, hopefully got paid a ton of money to do that. That's not really what we're interested in. What we're interested in is either when musicians lose the rights to their music because their label owned them, or, you know, the artist is dead and either their estate gives permission or it's just entered the public domain.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah. What are people thinking? You have them pulled up there?
Yeah, I do. Did you get any kind of word of mouth feedback that you want to share?
I did not.
Okay. All right. So,
everybody that I've talked to lately about the podcast is one or two episodes behind.
That's so. Similar thing happened to me.
We're moving
so
too quick.
We had some write-ins, and I talked to some people that had listened to it. Obviously, I think this is going to be kind of a theme for the next few episodes, so it's still a question that you should answer. But the majority of the answers that I got were along the lines of two things. One was that a lot of people said it's lazy. And That's interesting.
Yeah, that's surprising.
And then another group of people, and sometimes the same group of people, said that it's okay because it exposes more people to the artwork. And that is an answer that I had already thought of. I was wondering if we were going to get that or not.
I had thought of it, and thought of it as definitely a negative.
Exposing more people to the artwork.
Exposing more people to the artwork is a good thing.
Yes.
Exposing other people to a Walt Whitman poem by showing them a Levi's commercial. I mean, I don't know if that's really the same as having them sit down and read a Walt Whitman poem.
Of course, it's not the same, but
and I don't know if that's a good way to introduce art. I think it's like, you know, how many? Maybe it makes sense. I guess if you think about like some other like major works of art that you were introduced to in like a non-traditional way, sculptures that you see on notebooks or like the Mona Lisa's on like everything, you know.
So there's a lot of art that becomes a pop culture icon, like the Mona Lisa or the Japanese print of Mount Fuji, which, if you're not familiar, it's this giant waves that are really popular on Moleskine-style notebooks and you know,
I actually have a desktop
wallpapers.
Poster of it rolled up right next to my computer here.
So there's that where, like, art becomes a pop culture icon. But that's a little bit different than using a somewhat obscure piece of art or existing work inside of an existing ad or inside of a new ad. And so people saying, you know, it exposes more or a wider audience to the original work. I don't ever think that's the intention of the advertisers.
No.
That's never what they mean to do. I also think that answer, and I came to that answer as well, I think that answer to the question is based on the presumption that using existing art inside an advertisement is bad because it cheapens the art.
I don't know if it cheapens the art, but it maybe like they said earlier, maybe I think it more makes the advertising a little bit lazier. You know, who's the copywriter who's sitting there like, yeah, I'm going to use Walt Whitman. That's proven to be a good work of literature already for the last 50 years. I don't know.
I mean, not
writing your own. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'd like to see if Levi wrote their own commercial.
So
if it would be as effective.
We'll actually get to that in a minute. But
yeah.
I don't think that these Levi commercials using Walt Whitman, I don't think this is lazy at all. There is an ad that exposed me to existing artwork that I was not familiar with. It ended with the words, "This is the way the world ends," which is, of course, from... Dude, I'm going to quiz you here. Do you know, Tom?
I don't.
This poem? So if I showed you this ad, it would expose you to this new piece of art. It's "This is the way the world ends," and then the actual poem finishes with "This is the way the world ends. This is the way the world ends, not with a bang, but with a whimper," which is from T.S. Eliot's "The Wasteland."
Yeah. Yep.
Very, 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 you know, huge, seminal, gigantic piece of artwork. I'm going to cut out my read of it because I did a terrible job and it's not worthwhile.
Yeah. The issue I have with saying that it exposes you to the poem, especially with poetry, is that poetry is something that stands alone. If you could make a video that went with a poem, you just make a movie. Like if there was more, like as soon as you put this like video and these other aspects to the commercial, it becomes part of the work. You can't separate the T.S. Eliot poem from the commercial when you're watching it, unless you're in the other room and you're just listening to the T.S. Eliot poem. And so that's where I kind of have the issue with artist intent, maybe. not being there. So you're experiencing it in definitely a different way. Whether it's better or worse, it's not the same as everyone else was introduced to it.
My gut is that most artists would not want their work being used to sell pants. Does that seem true to you as well?
I think so.
I know everybody has a price, and like every living artist could be offered an amount of money where they would allow their work to be used in a pants commercial.
I think that most artists that I know anyway is, you know, they would be willing to maybe like do something with Levi's. But like, I think if I made, you know, if I had published a poem, like, you know, Bukowski's The Laughing Heart, Levi's used that in another one, like a great poem like that. And like, I didn't need Levi's to like subsidize my like abilities to make it as a poet. I think I'd be pretty irritated if 50 years after I died, they took it and were like, haha, now we're going to sell pants. Thanks for being awesome. Like, if somebody took my photographs of, like, me wearing Levi's, taking a dump, and they used that in
We should explain here, because you and I both know about this. Tom is a visual artist and has taken lots of photos of himself using... Well, I shouldn't say lots of
photos. One or two, a couple.
I'm familiar with a few good photos that are, you know, set up in a bathroom, and he's sitting on a toilet, and his pants are around his ankles.
And you just see kind of my pants. I'll link to the... image we're talking about in the show notes.
That'll be in the show notes.
And
which
so,
can be found, since the first time we said the word show notes, we gotta say, can be found at verbmill.net/thewhitehorsecourier/6, because this is episode six.
So that photograph, I mean, I don't think that photograph is gonna go down in history as a Charles Bukowski poem. Hopefully it does. Hopefully I get that famous. But, you know, if 100 years from now Levi's has that photo in one of their ads, and I somehow found out about it in the afterlife, I would be irate with Levi's. I'd be so pissed. I would be like, you know what? If you wanted me to take a photograph for your ad, you should have contacted me to make a photograph for your ad.
What if the photograph becomes a pop culture icon, like the Mona Lisa? Like it becomes so pervasive that it doesn't even exist as a painting by an author anymore. It becomes something entirely different. Like, everyone knows some of the history of the Mona Lisa. Or maybe not everyone. Maybe that's the point, is that not everybody knows, but everybody knows the image. And it exists outside of the existence of, you know...
Knowing.
Being painted by Leo. Our good friend Leo.
Our buddy Leo. He was quite a guy. I think that becomes a different thing and would be sort of... I don't know if I would like that. Right away, I want to say yeah, because that like instinct inside of all 21-year-old men who say, like, I want to be a rock star and I want everybody to see my stuff and associate it with me.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that, you know, the fact that I'm going to die before that would happen... I think it sort of dilutes, maybe, the work of art in a way. And I don't know if I'd be really okay with it. Maybe I would.
So
that's
so,
one. That's something very... That's different. I think I'd be less bothered by that.
I didn't hear that as a response from the people that sent in answers or tweeted at us, the people that I talked to. Nobody said it cheapens the artwork. But I think that's the initial reaction that everyone gets when they hear the question.
Yeah.
That if you take somebody else's work and then you use it to sell a product, or you use it in a way that was not intended, in a way you're cheapening their work. And you know, maybe it's intellectually lazy. I don't think this Levi commercial that we talked about last week was
lazy.
Intellectually lazy. I actually think they did a very good job of representing the poem. The other reference that I made, the T.S. Eliot poem, I don't think that ad was... you know, destroying or cheapening the work. I think it was in a way paying homage to the work. But most of the people, it seemed like they thought for a bit and then they said, well, it is exposing more people to the original work, and that's good. And I think that's an answer that people who don't make art often have. And that's interesting to me. I don't want to say that it's wrong or bad, but it is interesting to me. And it's the same answer that I kind of thought of when I was trying to find pros for using existing work in an advertisement.
Yep.
I'm very happy when it's done well, because I think that it does, in the end, expose more people to the existing work. I think it kind of elevates the content on television, because that Wieden Kennedy ad is beautiful and has, like, high art inside of it.
Yeah.
Which, you know, kind of distributes high art to more people, and that's awesome.
That's true.
And makes it, you know, palatable and enjoyable. And by giving it images, they can turn the work into something new. And I don't think that they were taking credit for it. I don't think they were, you know,
saying that it was their poem.
Yeah, they weren't saying it was their poem. They weren't even implying that, like, they had created this work to sell their pants as much as, like, putting their pants in line with the poem.
Yeah.
Which, that's, you know, more tenuous. But that's interesting as well. And I think that brings us to a nice transition to this week's ad, which is, again, from Levi's. This is a modern Go Forth ad. So if you missed the episode last week, what happens is there's this poem by Walt Whitman. We've been talking about it for a while. It's Pioneers, Oh Pioneers. It's a fantastic, wonderful piece of American history, really kind of a cultural definition of America in some way. The Walt Whitman poem is essentially young people doing young people things. It's exciting. They're moving quickly. They're having fun. There's fires and there's people, like, kind of dancing around. And it doesn't highlight pants really at all. Like, there's a couple scenes of people putting pants on, but for the most part, Levi's is backgrounded and the poem and the action and youth is foregrounded.
Mm-hmm.
All right. We're going to start this ad. And obviously, podcast listeners can't hear it, or excuse me, podcast listeners can't see this ad.
See it.
You can go find a link in our show notes, but you will be able to hear what happens.
This is a pair of Levi's, buttons and rivets and pockets and cuffs, and the thread that holds it together. When the road gets rough and the sky gets jumpy and the stars start falling on top of your head and the waves start breaking against your legs, it's the thread in your seams that's tied to your dreams. It's the soul in your feet that keeps the beat. You're gonna be great. You're gonna be great. You're gonna be great. You're gonna find the cure. You're gonna be famous. You're gonna be shameless. Spitting seeds in the wind. Tap dancing with your shoelaces pinned to the back of a bus at the end of the road at the bottom of the ninth with a crown on your head. You're a queen. You're a king. You're the solo act in a sold-out show at a six-story stadium. And you're proud. You're a hero. You got hero's grip, swinging by a single stitch. You follow your heart, follow the leader. You're the leader. Are you joking? Are you breaking? Are you shaking? You're the next living leader of the world. You're a kid, holding on to the thread that holds it together. This is a pair of Levi's.
So this is obviously an original poem.
Yep, yep.
And it's a lot less exciting video, because it's a lot more people putting on pants.
Yep.
There's a bigger variety of pants. There's maybe even a bigger variety of people. But
yep,
the message is entirely different.
Yeah. I guess this one felt a lot more like a commercial than the one we talked about last week.
Yep.
I think it was still a very successful ad in a lot of different ways. But, like, the idea of writing a poem for the ad became far more intentional, I guess, if that makes sense. You know, it was focused, again, like, the poem was focused around the jeans. And the movement of the poem was focused on this, like, lifestyle of this, like, fast, youthful, like, bom, bom, bom. Almost like a beat, like, some sort of,
well,
like,
the meter,
slam
the
poetry.
Meter of the poem was increasingly quick.
Yeah, yeah, very quick.
And the video was even faster than the meter of the poem.
Yeah, and so that, I think that allowed, like, writing that poem for the commercial allowed for more speed that you don't really get using Walt Whitman, other older, more historic American poems.
Last week we talked about the aggression and
yeah,
said that it was in some way aggressive, although not violent. I won't say that this is violent either, but I think it is far more aggressive.
Yeah, it's competitive almost.
It's competitive. It's also super egocentric.
Yeah. The line.
I don't mean super ego. I mean like very much egocentric.
Very, very.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like the line, you will be the next leader of the world. It's like, what? Is that what I want? Like,
this seems trite to me.
Yeah.
Like the whole poem is about how great you are. And I get that that's maybe in some way tied to the Walt Whitman poem, but the Walt Whitman poem is kind of like, we're a company and we understand you, youth.
And you guys, the youth are really great. Yeah. Not an individual from the youth are really great.
And like, I get this kind of like this downwards gesture of pride from the Walt Whitman commercial. And from this one, I get the idea that it's like people with an ego are making this and telling me this story and I'm supposed to buy into it. And it's almost like they're pretending to be my friend, and since they're pretending to be my friend, I don't believe them as much.
Yeah.
I think, interpreting this differently than other people, but that's a feeling I got on the first and the second few times I watched it.
I do think, however, that in a way, I think that's a successful aspect of the ad. And maybe I'm speaking for somebody else because, like, I sort of see it with you where, like, this, like, big, very, I'm not going to say super, this very egocentric ad sort of turns me off a little bit, turns me off of, like, what they're saying to me. But I think a lot of people sort of have this, like, they like pumping themselves up, especially, and it's very connected to what they're wearing and how they're being perceived on, like, first impressions. You know, like, I think a lot of people look in the mirror in the morning and say, like, you're awesome. I think that happens outside of you and I. Because we look in the mirror and we go, nah.
Yeah.
Oh, crap. You know?
Yeah, I mean, I don't need to overstate or, like really play up how egocentric it is. Because, I mean, it's not, like, it's not so overpowering that the rest of the commercial gets lost. But there is that element of, like, you doing this, you are great. And the way it's posed makes it seem like the person selling it believes it about themselves.
Yeah.
And there are some interesting shots that I wanted to pull out. One is at 31 seconds.
Okay.
This one stood out to me. And maybe was the moment that, like, I was lost in the commercial. Or I no longer had the potential to really believe it. So there's a frame at 31 seconds. This woman is facing away from the camera. She's putting on her shirt. So you see this exposed back for a second. And tattooed on her lower back.
Oh, I'm after the tattoo.
Okay. So there's that frame that you just barely see. There's tattooed on the lower back is it's these two F holes, right? Which are these kind of italicized Fs. They're the obviously the shape of an F hole in string instruments. Earlier, the same woman was carrying a cello case, and the next shot is of her playing cello. This is a tribute to an existing piece of art called Aang's violin. Are you still there, Tom?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
The video froze, but that's not a big deal.
Okay.
So this is a tribute to, or copy of, but I assume tribute to Aang's violin, which is a Man Ray print.
Yep.
So, and, you know, kind of has its own pedigree of being art that uses existing art that uses existing art, right? So it's a commercial with this F-hole tattooed on this woman. Man Ray used existing portraits, and he put these F-holes on a woman. And I've always read that piece as somewhat, well, not as a sexist piece, but a piece about sexism.
Yeah?
Because it's using the form of a woman to become the form of an instrument. And that's an interesting kind of duality. There's some interesting play there. I have known of lots of women getting this tattoo because in some ways it's a more beautiful form of lower back tattoo than some.
Yes, this is true.
But that was interesting to me that they chose to put that in. You know, it's obviously a tribute to Man Ray or well-known art. Or maybe it's selling it to people that will think, ha-ha, Levi's used this art that I know. Look at me being so snobby because I caught it. You know, at some level, maybe it is just pure marketing. But if you take the best, if you assume the best of intentions, it's not pure marketing. It's them saying, here's this piece of art that we respect. We're going to put it in. It kind of fits with everything that's going on. But to me, it seems vaguely sexist.
I think the way in which she's putting it on, this like sort of, again, like that sort of sexual pose she makes with her back too.
Yep, yep.
And the exposed back is big. In a weird way, there's like a shot earlier where you see a woman's underwear while she's pulling the jeans on. And this feels more, this woman feels more objectified than the lady who's
because earlier it actually just looks like a person putting pants on.
Yep.
But this and is obviously, like a, you know, they used an attractive person to do that, but like it's kind of in the realm of advertising. It doesn't feel, this feels more.
Yeah. A big old slap.
Slady. So I still like this ad. It's still a successful advertisement in technique.
Have you seen the movie or the film The Perfect Human?
I have not seen The Perfect Human.
It is
also I've not ever seen a film called The Perfect Human.
It is it's a short film by Danish film by, I'm going to butcher this name, Jorgen Leth.
I think I'm familiar think that's with that what it guy, is. But I'm not going to say his so, name because I would do worse.
Yeah. And so, yeah, I think it's by him. Let me double check this. Yeah, The Perfect Human, a short film by Jorgen Leth. And it's a poem. It's like being narrated. Or it's not a poem. It's a film that's being narrated. And there's like a man getting ready and a woman getting ready. And he's like very obviously saying what they're doing. But there's no real storyline. And it's just kind of complicated, kind of. It's kind of like a big, like, move in like the conceptual filmmaking when he did this in the 60s. But I keep getting a feeling of that when I watch this. So we'll make sure to put a link to The Perfect Human so they can see that. This idea of this, like, you know, this narrator that's like talking about these people, but isn't in the same room as these people and isn't interacting with these people, but the camera is very obviously like put in a place that the people would have to notice it.
Yeah, yeah, and they are aware of it.
And they're aware of it, but they're not aware of the narrator. And so that whole feeling in the white room they used. And so, but I think if anything, if they tried to make that connection to that, it was done as like a purely marketing thing.
Really?
I think so.
I like mean, they were probably copying style.
Yeah. They were like, this is, you know, something that is considered a good film, you know, so we'll use this style. And they could have even used it from another film that used it from, you know,
this is another White and Kennedy ad, so we can assume that they know what they're doing. And like they're obviously they're not being sloppy in this ad. They've made the decisions, and I think I'm glad I found this, because it is kind of the same ad as last week, but with original poem rather than existing poem. I don't think this commercial is anywhere near as fun to watch, and I don't think it's anywhere near as moving for me as a person. As a person who's interested in buying pants, you know, I'm not moved by this.
The one big difference for me was the focus on the pants this time around with this commercial. Where with the other one, there was like a emphasis on the, you know, selling the lifestyle. This sold the pants, and then the lifestyle came with the pants.
Yeah,
like the once other, you the put these pants on, ballsier. Yeah, like once you put these pants on, you have this lifestyle. Where the other one was like Levi was saying, like, I know what you need, and I'm making you these pants because you have this voice. You're this generation of people, and I'm making pants for you.
Yeah.
So I think that's one of the big differences why I thought the first one was more successful.
That's our second week of talking about Levi's, and we would still love some feedback about our question, which is, can you repurpose existing art to fit inside of advertisements? You know, is that a pro? Is that a con? Let us know.
How can you do it if there is a way? What are the ways you can do it?
It's fair. I should say a lot of people responded with, like, it's based on the context or the specific ad, and we would like to know, like, can you give us an example of it being good or an example of it being bad? Obviously, we both think that this Walt Whitman poem was an example of it being good, and are interested to see where we go from there. And otherwise, you can get in touch with us at verbmill.net. This has been episode 6 of The White Horse Courier. I'm Will, that's at Will Imholt.
And I'm Tom, at Tom Wixo.
And we'll talk to you next week.
Sounds good.
I'd like to welcome you on board of flight 797 this morning on into Los Angeles. Due to snow accumulation overnight, we're going to be proceeding toward the IC Center. Have the aircraft cleaned up. Snow and ice has accumulated, and then we shall be on the way to L.A. Once we are airborne, I'll give you a further update on the route of flight as well as the actual arrival time in Los Angeles today. Thank you very much, and I do wish you a very enjoyable flight with us today.
Saw the big city lights. I saw the people go by. But I'm going home soon. Fast as this plane can fly. And it's clear to didn't need nothing else. Why travel so far? All I needed was you. Wingman, fly me back home, where my love waits. Stay by her side. If I can just make her see, the man she knew wasn't me. I put the past far behind. I'm gonna make sure she treat her so fine. If she looks in my eyes, she'll see I mean every word. I've seen her smiling at me in every love song I've heard. Fly me back home, where my love waits for me. I'm gonna stay by her side. If I can just make her see. Wingman, fly me back home, where my love waits for me. I'm gonna stay by her side, 'cause that's where I